It is with excitement that I get to share with you that the Leukemia Foundation has developed a new resource. This resource is called the Online Support Service, where it provides a wealth of services to assist a person living with blood cancer throughout their patient journey. So whether you're a patient who has just been diagnosed, in treatment, or in survivorship, this service provides access to targeted learning modules, a suite of amazing services, and online programs. And you also have the ability to chat with an experienced blood cancer support coordinator at just one click. It gives people a personalized and intuitive way to learn about important topics, including what to expect beyond treatment. This service is simple to use and is filled with content curated by the Leukemia Foundation for people with any type of blood cancer. It notably features a digital energy coach to help patients manage fatigue. So jump onto our website and look up our new and exciting product called the Online Blood Cancer Support Service.
You get to a point in life where you think you're in control of everything, and all of a sudden it gets taken out from underneath you.
I guess I kind of felt ripped off.
It's just living in the moment and just being adaptable to situations.
Give people voices to talk about, you know what, that phase is often the hardest, and be prepared for it because it's not what you think it will be.
Talking Blood Cancer, a podcast for those facing blood cancer by the Leukemia Foundation.
Find the best way forward using their own purpose that they have in their life and using their passions.
I've lost fear and doubt. Like, I no longer doubt myself in situations, and nothing scares me.
That gives you another goal to work towards and a reason to live.
Hi, I'm Kate Arkadiv, and I am the host of Talking Blood Cancer. This podcast shares the stories of the people we have connected with who have faced a blood cancer, so that you, our listeners, can gain insight, find purpose, and take inspiration. Before we get into today's episode, the Leukemia Foundation acknowledges the traditional owners of the land on which we share these stories. We recognise their continuing connection to land, sea, and community. As the first storytellers of this country, we pay our respects to their elders, past and present. This story may contain content that some listeners may find difficult and challenging. We encourage anyone listening to take care of their own mental health and well-being. The purpose of this podcast is to share real-life stories of people living with a blood cancer, and any discussion of medical treatments is not an endorsement. We encourage you to seek advice from your treatment team if you have any questions regarding your diagnosis, side effects, or treatment. If you would like to talk to someone, or even if you would like more information on our services or today's episode, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. So, let's get into today's episode. Before we begin, we wanted to acknowledge that today's episode is a little different to one we've ever shared before. This podcast episode touches on themes of grief, loss, and the complexities that come along with the emotional healing after a loved one has passed. We encourage you to listen with kindness towards yourself, and if you're feeling overwhelmed, remember that it's okay to take a break or skip ahead to another episode that feels right for you. Your well-being matters, and we're here to explore these topics with empathy and understanding. In today's episode, I had the privilege of speaking with Neris Welsh, who courageously shares her journey of being a devoted caregiver to navigating life as a widow. She opens up about the profound loss and grief she has felt since the passing of her beloved husband and father of her three children, Richard. Neris reflects on the challenges she faced and the healing moments she discovered since Richard's departure. This conversation is such a beautiful blend of love, resilience, laughter,
and the rawness of the sadness that she has felt. We explore the truth that while not every day is filled with sadness, and neither is every day filled without difficulties. Join us as we honour Neris's story and the universal moments that shape our human experience.
Hi there, and welcome to Talking Blood Cancer. Thank you for joining us today. Today's episode is slightly different to the one that we've usually done in the past. Today, we are speaking with a lovely guest who unfortunately has lost a loved one, a husband, in fact, to blood cancer. And this is a really important topic, and it's one that we felt was really important to highlight and also to have that conversation with someone on the podcast about, you know, that unfortunate thing that does happen when someone loses their life to blood cancer, that the people left behind have to either rebuild their life and grieve, of course, as well. So today on the podcast, we have Neris, and we are so thankful for her time and for her being so brave to share her story with us. So thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Neris and I, we go a long way back.
Way back, yep.
Yeah. So just like any podcast, we always do ask if the guests could please, you know, tell us a little bit about who they are, who their loved one is and what they were diagnosed with, who is in their family and where are they living in Australia?
So my name is Neris Welch. My hubby, Rich, was diagnosed with T-cell ALL leukemia in 2012. At the time, we were living in Yatman in New South Wales, but now I live on the Fraser Coast in Queensland. We have three kids. They're now 14, 16 and 17.
But when was Rich first diagnosed? What year was that?
So he was first diagnosed in 2012, mm-hmm. which was when we first came to Brisbane and stayed at the Leukemia Village.
Yeah, yeah. And then during that time, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2012, I think more so in 2013, he did have a bone marrow transplant, didn't he?
Yes. So they found the leukemia July 2012, and then they got mm-hmm. him stable enough, and he actually had the transplant. It actually ended up on his birthday, which he was very unhappy about because he wanted a new birthday. Like when you have your transplant, you have your new extra birthday. But his was on his birthday, so he was not pleased about that. But yeah, so that was December 2012. He had the transplant, and then we were still in Brisbane. Yeah, we stayed at the Leukemia Village for over a year that time.
Yeah. And then after the transplant, you guys got to return home, didn't you? So for how long? But of course, you did need to come back very regularly to Brisbane. And how many years did you get between that and the next bump in the road?
Yeah, so we were able to leave in 2013. We came back home, and then initially it was sort of every week back and forth, and then over time it became every 2 weeks back to Brisbane. I think the longest we ever got was a month between having to come back to Brisbane, and that went on for about 6 years. The leukemia didn't come back, but he had constant graft versus host complications. He ended up having to have hip replacements, shoulder replacement, just ongoing treatment and stuff for the side effects from everything.
Yeah. And so at some point, did it return his leukemia?
No, the leukemia actually never came back. And that was what we were always so worried about. That was the thing you were, you know, every test,
yes.
Is it back? Is it back? And that was the big worry. And it never actually came back. He, in 2019, he started getting worse, but he'd been bad before. So it wasn't a panic. It was just, okay, this. And the graft versus host got a bit worse, but it had always been external.
But
and he just started retaining fluid and, you know, but it wasn't alarming. It was just another thing. And they decided to start him on a new medication that wasn't available in Australia at the time. So we came back to Brisbane. We were there for about 3 months waiting for the process to get the medication approved. And so that was the battle. If this medication doesn't get approved, then things may not go well. But we got the medication approved. So we were like, yes, this is it, you know. And then within a couple of weeks after that, he kept going in and out of the hospital, but he just, it was just another normal time. He went into a hospital, no different than the others, and then had no idea, because like I say, we were just looking for the leukemia to come hit us, and that wasn't, so we were good. But then,
because it's always been the worry, right, that people talk about, that that's, you know, that's going to be your biggest battle if it comes back. But yeah, in your case, that wasn't quite.
Yeah. And that's the thing, the fear, that's what you're always dreading. And there's always that relief when you have the tests and it's clear and, you know, so that's, your eyes are always on that. But yeah. And looking back now, I can see how much he deteriorated. But at the time, you're so in it and you're so just dealing with the day to day, you don't see it. And the first sort of indication I had was his oncologist sort of just let me know, hey, things aren't looking great. We may have to think about palliative care down the road, but we're like way out. And that was the first ever indication. And then just over that weekend, he just deteriorated rapidly. And yeah, he died a couple of days later. So we had a tiny bit of warning, but it happened so fast at the same time. So it was very unexpected, even though he was very unwell, if that makes sense.
And I envision so very fast, if that wasn't even on your radar, like that's not where your thoughts were quite heading, you know, like, and especially I imagine for the children as well, to think, as you said, like, oh yeah, daddy's been unwell before. And you know, you've seen Rich unwell before. So this is just another time like that.
Yeah. But I mean, the scariest time was when he first got diagnosed. And that battle from being diagnosed to getting to the point of having the transplant. In that time, we almost lost him a few times. And it was very much, you know, we don't know if this is going to work. But once he had that transplant and he recovered reasonably well from that, it wasn't that same imminent danger kind of thing. It was, he's not well, but, you know, adjust this medication, we'll do this. We've been here 50 million times. It's gone on for like 6-7 years. This is not new. And I think for the kids, I mean, when he was first diagnosed, they were, so the youngest was 3, the oldest was 6. So their whole lives were hospitals. They didn't know anything any different. They thought it was normal. And they still find it very, very strange that people don't spend lots and lots of time at hospitals. You know, I mean, they would come to the hospital every day and that was just their normal. They always came to every doctor visits. So they knew daddy went to the hospital, but they had no idea it was anything. They knew the word leukemia, but they had no idea. So yeah, we were all completely blindsided.
Yeah, absence. What a blindside. And were you able, I guess, throughout that weekend, you know, were you able to see it that, oh, okay, I think we're losing Rich. Were you able to see that at all? And have those moments that people talk about before someone passes?
I think by that point, I was just so exhausted because we'd been down in Brisbane for 3 months at that point with going in and out of hospital. He was doing like every day going back to the hospital for, you know, treatment and stuff. And it was just sheer sort of zombie survival exhaustion by that point. And then, I mean, it hit me a bit when they told me, but it was still, this is months down the line. So it wasn't imminent. It was, oh, this is not going well, but we've still got loads of time. So it was still more just the day to day. And then it wasn't really until sort of the day before that it's, you know, it started hitting me, but it was still just that constant look after the kids, do this. We told the kids the day before and that was rough, obviously. And that was sort of when it hit a bit more. But I was still, I couldn't just sort of step out and absorb it because I'm trying to look after him, talk to the medical people, look after the kids, you know, so you're just going, going, going.
Yeah. At those points, you wear so many hats. And I would envision that if your body and brain allowed you to fully absorb it and feel it and step into that emotion, you potentially may have not been able to do all the other roles that were required of you.
Yeah, it's that massive survival. I knew that I couldn't let it in. Like if I did, I couldn't look after the kids. I couldn't look after him. I couldn't I wouldn't have been able to function. I mean, I was barely functioning as it is, but it was that just like animalistic survival kind of kicks in, that you're just like, keep going, yeah. keep going. You can't stop. You can't think about it. Deal with that later.
Yeah.
To just get through it at the time.
And I wonder too, now that you are a solo parent of three beautiful children, does that feeling that you have still follow you through to this day?
Oh, yes.
Because it is just yes. you. It is just you that wears the mum hat, the dad hat, and you are the adult in the household.
Yes, and that is a huge, I mean, I know it's been 4.5 years since Rich passed away, and the first three were just, I don't even know. I was just surviving. I was just, I didn't let myself feel too much. I avoided it as much as I could because I knew I couldn't just take a couple of weeks out and just fall apart. That wasn't an option. So, and we were in a situation mm-hmm. where we were in the middle of building a house, so I had to finish that. So it was just, again, that survival just continued. And even now, it's still there. My grief, my feelings have to be put on hold a lot of the time because there isn't a backup. You are the only adult you are. And that responsibility is huge and can be really paralyzing when you start really thinking about it, because you're trying to be everything and you can't do everything that you did before because you're sleep deprived and you've got brain fog and you can barely function. Plus you haven't got your person to talk to, plus the person who, you know, used to do stuff.
So yeah. And you've got, they do talk about when someone does lose somebody, the grief brain kicks in, you know, that there's almost this protection that the brain and body can do to protect you. And they talk about that utter exhaustion and the almost sometimes a numbness, or I mean, everybody experiences it so differently, but I think people don't take into account physically how much the body takes on when one is in grief.
Yeah. And it affects everything. I mean, I used to read, like take that sense of, I used to read a lot before he passed away, and I couldn't read. I couldn't pick up a book and read. It was a couple of years before I could even attempt it. And I couldn't even read. I had to come train my brain to read again by reading like kids' books and young adult fiction books and books that were not books I would ever read before, because I couldn't do anything that was similar. So, and it took me a couple of years. Now I can read again.
Interesting.
But not the same. Like I still, there's sort of a level of book I can get to. And above that, I know I cannot think as clearly or keep as many balls up in the air at the same time, because you're starting already exhausted mentally and physically and emotionally. So you just cannot do the same that you could before.
Can I ask, did you have to learn that and learn to accept that you can't do, or that you are different?
Yes.
Post losing Rich?
I am still trying to learn that, because inner me still says, no, you should be able to do that. Why can't you do 50 million things on your to-do list today? And why are you failing at this? And then kind of have to go, yes, but you only slept 4 hours last night and you're doing this and doing, you know. And it's a constant battle. And I think the thing that helped me the most was, because I tried to read like books about grief and I couldn't follow them. I just couldn't mm-hmm. to start with, until I started talking to other people who were also grieving, which wasn't probably till about year three. Then I started realizing, okay, this is normal. This is not, there's not something wrong with me. This, oh yeah, I can't concentrate on stuff. I thought it was just me. But no, that's a common thing, you know. And so you start to learn more about it and learn how it affects you and strategies and things that can help. It's still hard, but yeah.
Can I ask, you know, as I was listening to you talking and you speaking about the brain fog, and I think especially for blood cancer patients, and not that I have had someone with a blood cancer or lost someone to a blood cancer, but I envision and I can see that there's so much trauma already that comes with a diagnosis and the treatment and the tides of it. But then to lose somebody on top of the diagnosis and the treatment, do you feel like the trauma, or you're in trauma essentially throughout all of this, and do you feel that you become, you're unpacking it more, or you're feeling it more once you've lost someone?
I think it's, I mean, every type of way someone dies is hard, and every grief is different. But I think when you've been a caregiver and a caregiver for someone with blood cancer, your starting point is so lower because you've had so many years of that caregiving. And blood cancer is not something that you ever just go, yeah, we're in remission, yay. You don't have that ever kind of end point where you can feel that massive sigh of relief. So you're always that alert for things, and you never relax, and that state. So, you know, I came into the grief being absolutely physically drained to start with. So I think you have to take that into account of where you're at further down the line. And then you add in all that trauma of, because you were the carer, you feel responsible. You know, you have that, I should have done something. And you know, logically, you did everything you could. You know, if the doctors and the specialists couldn't save him, you know, I wasn't going to save him. But because you've been the person who, you know, I would talk to the doctor, share what's happening with him, look after his meds, do all that stuff, you feel responsible for it. And so,
yeah,
it's better now.
It gives you a purpose,
but
too.
You still have flash. You know, a lot of times you just go back over what happened at the hospital, what happened at the end. Should I have noticed this? Should I have said that? You know, and there's always that playing. And then I kind of had like another thing that when he died, so then we stayed in Brisbane for 2 weeks, then we came back home. And it was also this weird kind of feeling that I also lost my job because I was his carer. And now I wasn't, that role suddenly gone. And it also felt like I moved town because Brisbane was like our second home. We were there so much for like 7 years. So many people I interacted with, we were at the hospital all the time, you know, from like the person behind the counter at the shop or whatever. Like, I knew these people, and suddenly you're just like, yeah, go away. And all that changes as well. So you're just like, yeah, your whole world's just like spinning because you've lost your person, you've lost your location, mm-hmm, you've lost your job. You're just like, it's a weird mix.
It would be. And I think you're so right. Like, there's so much when you're in a blood cancer and, you know, you're fighting that battle that you're like, I just want this to be done and be gone. I don't want to see the receptionist on the outpatient chemo level anymore. I just want to go back to normal. And then you're right, when that stops and you've lost your person, and again, it's out of your choice, that I would envision you would almost give anything to go back there because it means that your person is still by your side. It's not a bed of roses, absolutely, but your person's there, yes, with you.
And I mean, that was the whole thing through the leukemia journey was, I mean, it was horrible. It was hard. It was horrific. It was scary, but he was there. And, you know, whatever we did together. We always said, as long as we have each other, we can tackle anything. So, yeah.
Yes. And you guys were, you were such a beautiful, strong unit. And I'm going to say you still are, because I absolutely know that he is with you and your children and within your spirit. And has that been, I mean, that has come so naturally to you guys to continue to bring Rich along in daily life and to speak about him. Is that right? Am I right in assuming that and knowing?
Yes, definitely. I mean, he's always going to be a part of my life. He's always going to be part of the kids' life. And, you know, he's referred to every day in our house. We always talk about, oh, daddy this, or, you know, daddy would like this. We make jokes that daddy's done something, you know. If I can't find something, they'd be like, oh, daddy's gone and hidden it on you. You know, he's still an everyday part of our life, which is really, really nice in our little bubble with me and the kids. And it's hard outside of that bubble with sort of the general world, how people don't like talking about someone who's passed away and how people will avoid it and how much that adds to, I know it's added to my grief of just, I want to talk about him. I want to say his name. I want to say Rich. I want people to talk to me about him. I want people to let me know they thought about him, tell me a story about him, or just tell me you're sad, you miss him, you know, because it makes you feel less alone. And I think so many people just don't know what to say, so they don't say anything. But that's worse, you know, because then you feel like everyone's forgotten about him, that he never existed. But I think it's a common thing, like all people want is to be remembered. Like when we're not here, we want to be remembered for who we were and what we did.
And an impact being made.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest thing. And the few times people have mentioned him, it's kind of like this time travel machine, because then he's here, he exists, people remember him. And so it's a very precious thing when people do talk about him.
And it's the acknowledgement of, well, really, you know, that your loved one isn't here, but other people are bringing them in the journey of life and pulling them forward. And I understand and can see that for many people who are grieving, that can be really hard to say their name. But I do believe that it won't always be as hard as it is in the beginning. And it's almost like training that muscle, or, you know, you never touch it. It's forever going to be hard. But if you stretch yourself a little by little to go, oh, I'm going to mention him. And if I cry, that's okay. Because crying's such a normal reaction, isn't it? I'm sure you've shed thousands and thousands of tears throughout this time.
And I think it's that accepting that it's okay to be sad. You know, it's okay to cry about it and to laugh about it. Like all the emotions are okay. And you can have both at the same time. You know, a new thing happens with the kids and I'm happy and you have all those good emotions about it. And equally at the same time, I am sad because he's not here or he's not, you know. So you can have that duality. You can have more than one emotion at the same time. And I think that's always going to be the case. Mm. You know, the happy is always going to come with that sad.
And I believe you're so right. And I believe that grief in some way is a thief because it does, as you said, you beautifully have those happy moments when something's going on with the kids, but it does slightly get stolen or tainted because you go, oh, it's just that next reminder. I mean, every day is a reminder, but it's that ping of going, oh, Rich isn't here. Or my loved one's not here as well. And that, I think, too, the whiplash of those feelings, just like when you were first diagnosed, you do adapt to it, don't you?
Yeah. And I think as time goes on, it doesn't get better, but I think I've built more supports around it and more things are not the first time I'm doing them. So sort of, I don't like new normal, but like you get to sort of this, I'm okay-ish. But it just takes one thing and it's like the waves of grief, you know, and there's always something new or a trigger or, you know, especially with kids. I mean, kids are constantly new stages, new development, new events, finishing school, doing this, whatever's happening. There's always those things that as a parent, you grieve that, you know, the other parent isn't there. But then equally, the kids' grief changes as time goes on and they have those waves coming when there's something that they want dad there. So there's no finish line. And I think that's the thing, like you'd never complete grief. It's always going to be that. You just have to, over time, like a long, 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 long time, you can put some things in place to help you at some point in it. But you're still going to be on the floor sobbing at time. You know, it's not a cure.
So right. And would you say that, you know, how you mentioned that you put some things in place and did you have to get to a point to say, okay, this isn't working or this isn't changing unless I do something or allow people in? Did you have to get to that point or did it naturally just happen for you that you allowed people into support?
Definitely initially it was just that survival. I wasn't even thinking, it was just practical. It was just, how am I going to get to this? How am I going to sort this out? And the fog. And I think around the year three, I started sort of going, okay, well, I hadn't really met anyone else who was grieving at that point. So I think Shirley from the Leukemia Foundation, she kept in touch and I started having counseling with her, which helped. And then I joined some of the online Leukemia Foundation bereavement meetings. They had like one where I can't remember how many weeks, it was 4 weeks or 6 weeks. And we met every week. And that was... Yes. That was sort of the start of me going, oh, okay, there are other people out here who get it, you know, and how it made me feel so less alone. I know I needed more of that. I needed more so. Yeah, I just went crazy searching, Googling, trying to find anything I could find that I could go to. I knew in my own circumstances, I couldn't meet in person. You know, I'm still a carer for my three kids, so it wasn't an option to go and meet and have a coffee with someone. So I just kept...
And COVID was happening.
He passed away August 2019. So then the next year we had COVID, so things weren't possible. But the only good side was things went to Zoom and online and virtual, and then suddenly became all these options. So yeah, I just started joining things. I found a lot of support groups in America. So I just joined them. I just kept joining things and hoping no one would kick me out and be like, go away. And they didn't, so it was great. So I've sort of over time collected like things and got to know other people in the same situation. And yeah, it's just that knowing everyone's situation is different, but every time I go to something, there's always one little thing that, you know, just connects. And being able to talk to people who understand all the backstory, who get all the challenges, the ups, the downs, who if you say, my lawnmower broke and I actually figured out who I had to call to fix it and I got it fixed. Yay. They're all like, yay, you know, and they celebrate because they know how.
They understand how they get it.
And that makes all the difference, you know, and it kind of gives me the strength in between talking to them for when I'm around people who don't get it. It just, I don't get as angry now when people don't understand. I've now realized how little... Generally speaking, if you haven't experienced like close grief, you don't know what it's like and you don't know what to say and you don't know what to do. And you'll say all the wrong things because you think they're the right things because they're the phrases that people say. And they don't realize that they're actually hurtful and not helping. And you just want someone to acknowledge it, to just be like, that really sucks. You know, I'm sorry that happened. And do you want to talk about it? Or that's sad. That sucks. You just want that acknowledgement. You can't fix it, you know, but yeah.
Absolutely. Because I do think our society, we do deal, and within our culture, within Australia, we do deal with grief somewhat poorly, I would say, in the fact that we who observe grievers, we don't know how to instantly act, just like you described. And it takes the one who is grieving and who needs the love, the support, the scaffolding to be the one to guide and to have to stand up and go, hey, I need help, instead of people just jumping in or, as you just beautifully said, plainly acknowledging, this is really shitty. This isn't where I thought I would be or wanted to be. And that's tiring. And I would love to be able to shift that within our culture, that we don't make the one who is struggling put their hand up, that we just know innately how to do that. But I think that that's a lot of work ahead to do that.
So. Yeah, and I think that's sort of where I'm at now. I feel able to talk about my journey and share how it's been for me, because I sort of feel like now if I don't speak up and say, hey, this is what it's been like, this is what helps, this doesn't. And again, it's different for every person. So something that helped for me is not necessarily going to help someone else. But, you know, the basics, then I can't expect the outside world to change and know how to do it if I don't share and I feel I can. That doesn't mean everyone should have to share their grief journey if they don't want to. But that's sort of where I'm at now. It's like, I want to be honest about what it's like and how hard it is. And it's still, I'm 4.5 years out, but that doesn't mean I'm okay now. I have okay days, but I'm also have sobbing on the floor days, you know, so it's always going to be a part of my life.
And it's much what, in some way, you know, the patients go through in themselves when they've recovered or they've gotten to remission. You know, they're still walking around with that invisible disability. You as a griever are walking around with invisible grief. You know, the person who may pass you in the shop has no idea that you just spent 10 minutes in the car sobbing because you heard a song that reminded you of Rich, but hey, you're here picking up bananas from the store and they can't see that you're incredibly sad on the inside.
Yes, I definitely had a while of feeling quite judged on the criteria, because I think people just want to make it better. They genuinely can. They want to make it better. So they need to feel like, okay, she's doing okay now. So they rate it on, okay, she's gone out to the shops, she's bought her bananas, she's doing better. It does. I just needed bananas. Well, I needed to eat. I'm not cured. That's not the parameter. Yes. Where, oh, grief's gone. Bananas in. It doesn't work that way. And I think it's just that it's okay that it's always going to be a part of my life.
Yeah. And even if one has moved on and repartnered, that I think people also see that as a marker to go, oh, well, she's moved on from, the one that she lost. But in actual fact, that person forever will come through in every relationship and every interaction because it's impacted their life. And, that doesn't just because someone, as I said, has moved on and repartnered doesn't mean they've moved on. They've just moved forward because they've had to. What other choice does one have? Time continuously ticks on, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the group psychological stuff, there's many widows who are trying dating or dating or have got remarried, but they're still widows. They still have the grief. The grief hasn't vanished just because they've been able to find a new person to share their current life with. They still have the grief that still impacts stuff. They still need support. So it doesn't, it doesn't just vanish because they found a new person to be with.
Because it's not like a divorce, is it?
No, and that is something left. That's often compared to of people, I understand, I'm divorced, I know what it's like. And you're like, you don't. It's not the same.
No, you don't.
Or the single parent, like I love you, use the solo parent because, it's different. It's not the same as being a single parent, because there isn't the other parent around somewhere to potentially step in. It is just, it's different.
Yeah, the weight and the responsibility of a solo parent is very heavy because also, you don't want anything happening to yourself. Like that would I envision be a fear. I know it would be a fear for myself as a parent. You don't want anything to happen to you. And you guys have experienced that terrible things can happen as well. So
yeah. And that is something I think that is a big part of grief is the fear because you've had something, whether it was from, like a blood cancer or a sudden death or however it's happened, you've had the worst thing happen and you know it is real. It can happen. And I know ongoing, and it seems common among people who are grieving, that you have that ongoing anxiety over your health, other people's health. And it was not something I ever was anxious about. I never had anxiety. If I was having a blood test or a scan or something, it was just, very minor because it was just a routine thing. Whereas now everything is, that worst possible outcome could actually be the worst possible outcome, So it changes.
And how do you deal with that?
Try and just do it and freak out. I don't have a solution, honestly. Yeah. It's really hard. And I get very anxious over, what would happen if something happened to me, whether it was the worst case scenario or just something smaller, like I had to have a surgery, who's going to look after the kids? Who's going to do this? And it is a very horrible feeling. And my current strategy is distraction. I distract myself from it because I don't know how to. Yeah, I haven't figured that out yet. So,
but I think the thing that you can rely on, Neris, is that when something bad happens, you manage it. You have no choice, but your instincts kick in. And I think you need to trust yourself. Yes, it's horrible and it could be horrific that you're having to go through something again. And whether that is you simply get ill and you can't cook the kids dinner, but you manage and you can get through it. And this too shall pass. It may be wobbly while it's passing, but it will pass at some point.
I think you really learn to, I kind of call it picking your battles and just, what is the most important thing? Like every day I have this endless list of things that, I should really be done, but I'll just pick one thing that is like, okay, this really matters that I get this done today. And I just try and get that done. And anything else is a bonus. And you figure out, okay, I'm going to do it this way because this suits my family right now. That's all I can cope with. No, we can't go to that. It's too hard. Mm-hmm. It might be fun when we get there, but I just can't do it.
Yeah.
And you've got to pick what you can.
Do you become unapologetic?
Yeah. Yeah. You do just sort of, in the end, what anyone else thinks, that doesn't factor in to when I'm making decisions. I'm just doing what is best for me, for the kids. I mean, when Rich was here, it was what was best, that, you know, his illness impacted what we could do. You know, there was lots of stuff we just couldn't do because, you know, I had to be there for him, or he wasn't, or he was having a bad day, you know, and you just learn that's what's important. You do what you can when you can. And if today is not the day, well, it doesn't matter. It'll still be there tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's some really beautiful wisdom that you've given, because you have to surrender and you have to put yourself first. And if your person's gone, they're not being your sound. You don't have that sounding board going, oh, you really, like, you're tired, you've pushed yourself too far. Like, no, come on, let's not do that. But you have to be that voice in your head now as well.
Yeah. And I have found that finding other people who get it helps a lot as well, because sometimes you just get in your head and it can be something really minor, but you just... Mm-hmm. You just can't figure it out. You just cannot work out what the next step is. Or, you know, Rich was my best friend, so we talked everything through together. And then just that process of, like, mm-hmm. verbalizing a situation and explaining it to someone else just really helps. And that's where my widow friends and the grief women have really helped me process stuff and just talk through things that otherwise I'd just be, I don't know what to do. My brain just goes, ah.
And did that come natural to you to want to reach out? I mean, I know you reached out first to Shirley, and that's one-on-one. Like, was that a big step for you?
It was a big step for me to try it, because I think at that point I just felt like, well, this isn't going to help. This isn't going to help me solve my practical problems. This isn't going to be someone who can come and look after the kids so I can go fall apart. So what's the point, you know, of talking about it? But because I hadn't talked about it very much, so it was this kind of nice, gentle kind of stepping into that process of actually, like, talking about Rich, talking about how I felt, or just what was bothering me that week. You know, a lot of the times it was just, I got to have a good rant because the tap had broken and I didn't know what I was going to do, and she listened, you know. So that helped me realize that was helping. And then when I tried the online groups, just that connection on that just made me go, yeah, this is what I need. This is what I'm missing to help me get through it. I need to do this for me. I can't keep going this way. If I don't get that support, I'm not going to be able to keep looking after the kids. I'm not going to be able to do this, you know? So I needed that for me. And that was a big step. That was sort of around the year three mark of even thinking of anything for myself, you know. And it was small, but it was still a big step to actually do something. Yeah,
it was an outlet for you, I envision, you know. And even if it was just an hour or so out of a week, that's not a, you know, it's not a big percentage out of a week, you know, 7 days. That it sounds like it really gave you some, just that relief you needed to be able to function at a level.
Yes, because I think if I talk to anybody else, you know, people who outside of sort of the grief world, like either grieving themselves or like you guys around it, they just wanted to fix it. They didn't want to sit and listen. They didn't want to hear about it. So having someone who was just basically there just to all listen, you know. But I mean, I'd met Shirley. I met her at the Leukemia Village, so we had that connection going back. It wasn't a brand new person, so it was a really nice, gentle way to kind of ease into it. And she got all the leukemia stuff, you know. She understood all the caring for someone with leukemia, how blood cancer works, all its uniqueness. And that made a big difference of making it easier to sort of not have to explain all that when I couldn't even explain it myself, you know.
Yeah. I remember you and I talking before this interview, and you said something that I went, oh, that makes so much sense. That you said when you went into a group and you heard people speaking about certain types of drugs or processes or protocols or whatnot, how that gave you some almost sense of, I've had a complete blank, like fondness. You went, oh my gosh, I remember that. Like, I remember someone else gets, you know, what the steroid, you know, highs are.
Yeah, because I still go, so the Leukemia Foundation does things like every 2 months, and I still go to those. I went to one recently, and it was just so nice to just be around those familiar words and people who, like, near it, and just mentioning, yeah, like the medication or the treatments. And it's just a couple, because it was my whole world. Like, for 7 years, that was my world. I knew all what treatments, what it was, what the doctors were doing, what this meant. I learned all this medical stuff. I went in knowing nothing about it, but you come out at the end having all this knowledge, and then you're just like, yeah, nah, we're not going to talk about that anymore. So it was, yeah, it was really weirdly comforting to hear all that stuff and be around it again. It was nice in a very strange way, but it was very comforting.
Comforting is the word I was looking for. Thank you. And, you know, parenting alongside grief is a tricky thing. You mentioned you have three children, and as we all know, every human being is uniquely different. And I envisioned that at you, not only were you holding your own grief, but you were holding three children's grief, and I imagine it was all very different at every point in time. Was that exhausting and challenging within itself?
Very much, yeah. And I think that's the extra layer you have. I had my grief, but then I also had three kids with each with their own grief, and still now varies up and down. You'll have, you know, at times one who just wants to talk about him, wants to be massively sort of absorbed in the whole world of daddy, and then someone else who's just, I can't think about it right now, and trying to juggle that conflict. Mm-hmm. And how it keeps coming up for them is also sort of, I have my light roller coaster with grief waves, and then I have the other three with their own grief waves. I might be having like a okay-ish day, but one of them is having a horrific day and the grief waves are up. So then I get the grief wave as well. So you take on theirs as well. So you get, it's a sort mm-hmm. of weird dynamic, and it's how new things come up and things that they want to share with him and can't, or they want to know stuff. But we've always talked about it, and we have like little, we call them family meetings, and we'll plan things. So if it's Father's Day or his birthday coming up, we always, you're like, okay, what would you like to do? Do you want to talk about on the day? Do you want to ignore the day? We're going to do this. We're going to watch a movie that's his. What food that daddy liked are we going to get? You know, and they get really excited because I always get, it's just flavored water that's orange flavored, but Rich always drank it. And to them, it's a big treat. So we always have that on mm-hmm. special days. So it's talking with them and making sure they know it's okay to be sad. They know it's also okay to be happy, because I think that's a big thing too, you know. So I share, mm-hmm. oh, I'm missing daddy today, I'm having a bad day, and they'll give me a hug, which then makes them able to say it to me. And we have mm-hmm. a notebook that we write stuff in. So we share, we write little notes to Rich, but we also write down memories. So if we're talking and we remember something that he did or a YouTube video that he showed them, we'll write it in the notebook. So we're kind of gathering the memories for them mm-hmm. as they get older and they don't remember stuff, they can look back and there's somewhere they can help them remember things.
Which that is just so important. And, you know, I think it also ties back to, as you said, where people don't talk about loved ones that have passed, like in their communities, and people that knew the loved one also knew Rich in this circumstance, that people forget people who have, you know, for the children who have lost a parent or a grandparent or anybody. But we hold as adults, or people who are older than the ones before us, we hold all those memories. And if we don't talk about it and share it, we don't allow that next generation to bring that person that they also love along in their life and be able to feel them. And if those stories aren't shared, then how is one to know what their daddy was like? Or, you know, how did mummy like their cup of tea at work? Or, you know, what nuances did grandpa have, or something like that? You know, it's to speaking, I understand, is hard and uncomfortable, but it's so, so important to share the love and the memory and the stories.
Yeah,
as well.
I think it's also like sometimes people think it's got to be the big things. You know, they've got to share the epic tale of the time this really interesting thing happened. But a lot of times it's just the little things, you know, just something that seems very mundane, but is so special because it's just an extra little bit. Like I have a photo that I love because it's a picture of the kids and it's just got Rich in the background. And he's just, it's just the way he's opening this bottle of drink that is just the particular way he used to put his hand to open it. And I just happen to have caught it in the background in this picture. And it's just so precious to me because it's just that little memory that it's not a big thing. It's not the perfect picture or the perfect story, but it's just one little thing that brings back those nice memories. So it doesn't have to be an epic, hilariously funny tale. You know, it can just be some small thing that happened.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. Yeah, it's a quirk. It's a quirk that sometimes quirks are forgotten, and the quirks are when they're, you know, added up or what make a person.
Yeah.
So it's important to, you know,
it's not
the
things that, you know, bring back the nicest feelings. They're not the things of, oh, this is the job they did or this is what they achieved. It's that essence. It's those little things, and that's what makes a person. That's the things that you remember afterwards. That's something for just day to day life. Like, those are the things that matter. It's not, the kids aren't going to remember this massive epic toy you bought them, but they're going to remember how daddy used to sit and listen to them, or his silly stories, or his little jokes, or, you know, how he'd have his coffee, or the time he dropped a biscuit in mummy's tea by accident. You know, it's little things that they remember. It's not the big thing. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I absolutely agree.
You've now, like, you've had this grief, you're living this grief. It's a daily reminder, and it's with you for every step you take. Is there something that you have felt you've done, or that you've harnessed this grief to do something with? Have you had that happen for you at all?
I think for me, I found so many things that helped me in, like I said, just the endless Googling and finding stuff. And then I realized that I wanted to now reach out and help other people. I wanted to do something with all this knowledge, for want of a better word, and resources and stuff that I found, so someone else didn't have to spend, you know, all this trial and error finding stuff. So I decided at the end of last year that I would start my own group, and I came up with the name My Grief Tribe, because I figured that's what I wanted. I wanted my tribe of people who got it. So yeah, so I started a Facebook group, and there's a Facebook page that's public to try and educate or spread awareness of what grief is like for anyone, not necessarily someone who's grieving. And then I did sort of the Facebook group for actually people who are grieving, so we can talk more privately. And then I've done a website and a blog, and it's pretty new, but I'm just starting to share like resources and just what my grief journey was like, in the hope that it'll just help. If it helps one other person feel not alone, then that would be amazing.
That is so beautiful, because we all want connection, and what you're doing is helping people create connection. And you lost a big part of your tribe, which was Rich. And it's beautiful that you were creating a community for people to find a space where they can be connected and feel seen again in their grief. That's beautiful.
Yeah, I've made it. So it's Australian-based, but I've done it so it's open to anyone all over the world, because grief is the same no matter where you are. But I wanted to make sure I highlight Australian resources, because I couldn't find anywhere that had links to all the different groups, you know, that would had access to that sort of stuff. So it is a lot focused on Australian resources, but I do put like global stuff that I've found that I've accessed that's helped me as well.
And you're right. I mean, you reached out. You found some wonderful resources by the sounds of it too in America. So grief, it's international in some way, isn't it? So thank you for pulling that together. That's absolutely beautiful. And we will put that in the show notes so that anybody that is listening or experiencing grief, that they can go along and find the grief tribe and find some people who understand the journey as well.
That would be amazing.
Can I ask, you know, as you said, 4.5 years on, are there things or things that you feel you'd like to highlight or that you can share? Well, you do usually ask people to share some golden nuggets throughout the episode, and you've beautifully done that. But is there anything in particular that you would like to share with listeners?
I think some of the biggest things for me was that there's no right or wrong way to do grief. You can't fail at it. If you're crying, if you're not crying, if you need to think about them at Christmas, if you want to pretend they never existed at Christmas, you know, like there's no, you can't do it wrong. However you are is okay. That's your grief. That's what you need in that moment. And people will try and tell you, you should do this. You need to do this. You need to go out. You need to stay home. You shouldn't be doing, you should do more, do less. Everyone has an opinion, but you're not doing it wrong. You're not doing it right. You just are doing it, you know. But you're not alone, and to just try and find those people that make sense for you in your grief, that you can connect with, that you can be genuine with, that you don't have to put on. We talk about sometimes like a mask that you put on as a griever, your I'm okay mask, you know, when people ask, how are you? I'm fine. You're not fine, but you know, there's no point. The person doesn't want to know. Yeah, so that fake mask. So if you can find people that you can take that off with and just be real, just be truly honest about if you're having a good moment, a bad moment, that just relieves some of that pressure. That just helps you get through the next day, the next week. And that's what I found to help.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. You need to find someone that will hold your space, because there aren't many people that will hold your space. And, you know, you could say, hi, I'm terrible. Thanks for asking. You could absolutely say that. But then that comes with having to then manage that person's response and that person's grief. And you're like, I actually can't be bothered. I can barely deal with my own, let alone somebody else's. Yeah.
You end up sort of, you oftentimes end up trying to comfort and console the other person where you went into it as the one who desperately needs just a little tiny bit of comfort.
And I think that also comes down to being emotionally connected to the person as well, like where if you do outsource that to, say, like someone at the Leukemia Foundation, like our grief counsellors or within the group, they aren't necessarily emotionally attached to you or your story. So they absolutely have all that beautiful empathy for you and want to wrap you up, but there's that space that is wholly yours to control and to say judgment-free and to celebrate your wins when you fix the lawnmower and things like that by yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Naris, I can't thank you enough for your time, and I wish you and your beautiful children just happiness is what I want. I know that Rich will be forever weaved within all of your lives. I know that he's not physically here, and that is exactly where we all want him to be for you all. And if we could change it, we absolutely would. But you all honor him every day. And I know that he is incredibly proud of you all. And I just can't thank you enough for being so vulnerable and open with me today.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for letting me talk about Rich.
Oh, anytime, say his name and say it loud. Yeah. Well, thank you.
And as we finish this episode today, we wanted to leave you with a little poem from Emily Coxhead. To those who are grieving someone no longer here, whether a long time ago or just this year, say their name out loud, cry your eyes out, be proud. Nothing can be said to make it better. Maybe you could write them a little letter. In between the sparkles, it can feel pretty dark. There's a special place where they left their mark. Grief is the price we pay for love. Look at the moon and stars above.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. We hope that you have found it helpful in some way. We here at the Leukemia Foundation are a proud member of Talking Health Tech Podcast Network. If you would like more information on today's show or our services, please feel free to call 1-800-620-420 and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. Also, if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe, share, or even give us a rating on your podcast app. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Kate Arkadiff, and you've been listening to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer.